Excited about jumping into the scriptures this morning with you. Now this morning we're going to be looking at two texts, Genesis 37 and Genesis 39. And so if you have your Bibles, you can go ahead and turn there right now. I believe if you're going to be using the blue Bibles, that's page 60 in the blue Bible right in front of you. But before we actually read the text, I'm going to take you on a bit of a roundabout adventure until we get there. There's some things that I want to explain before we get there, and I trust that as I do, it'll all make sense. What I want to do this morning is I want to begin by talking with you about how to read biblical narrative well. Okay? I mean, when we read the scriptures, it's one thing to let our eyes pass over the words. It's another thing to actually understand what we're reading, and it's even more to get to the heart of it all. All of us know how to read stories. The question is, do we read biblical stories well? Now, because all of us have grown up hearing stories and going through school reading stories, we've been trained, so to speak, that as we're reading stories, we center in on the central characters and we just intuitively pay attention to the intrinsic qualities and actions that happen in the story. And so if you've ever picked up The Lord of the Rings, you can't help but observe Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin and Gandalf and Gimli and all of these characters. And without even thinking, you're making little assessments along the way about who they are and what they're doing. And along the way, a good story always evokes your story. And you find yourself saying, at that crucial point of decision, would I be that strong? Would I be that courageous? Would I turn and run away at that critical point? This is what a good story does. It draws us in, and then it speaks to us about our own story. It's powerful. Now, when it comes to stories, there's nothing inherently wrong with looking at specific characters and asking the question, is this a character trait that I want to emulate? Is this the person that I want to be like? There's nothing wrong with that. But if that's all we do when we read the biblical story, then we just might miss the point. Because we might be able to read the story and completely push God to the margins. Now, our story this morning in Genesis 37 and 39 is a fantastic case in point. As we read through the story of Joseph and his brothers and Potiphar and his wife, you could very quickly conclude that Joseph is good, his brothers are bad, Potiphar is kind of good, his wife is bad. Be like Joseph and maybe Potiphar, don't be like his brothers or like Potiphar's wife. But I want to suggest if we read the story that way, we're going to miss the whole point of it. There's something else going on in the biblical narrative every time we open the scriptures. It's something that's deeper and wider. It involves these human actors in this grand drama of God. But beyond that, all of the scriptures are ultimately about Him, about who He is, about what He's doing, about what it is He's trying to accomplish on the grand stage of human history. In every biblical story, God is both director and chief actor. Or to use more of a musical term, God is both the maestro and He's the featured soloist. So when we read about Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Jacob and now Joseph, there may well be character qualities that you might want to emulate in your life. But what the author of Genesis wants us to see is God. He wants us to see who He is and how He is working out His plan in human history. The book of Genesis, and in fact, the entire Bible tells the story of a God who is fully committed to putting this world back to rights. God is the author of beauty, as we've been saying week after week. He's the author of beauty, not brokenness. And God is actively at work, and He's seeking to rescue and to restore everything that's ever been broken. God began this rescue operation by choosing a family, Abraham and Sarah and their kids, and saying, I'm going to bless you. My hand of favor is going to be with you. And through you, everyone else will know who I am, and they'll come to know me too. And so, as we read every biblical narrative, the question we have to be asking is, where's God in the story? What is He doing? And how is He working out His plan through these people? So, the reason I've started by explaining all of this before we get to the scriptures is because I don't want us to miss the point this morning. We're going to observe Joseph going through some pretty ugly trials and temptations. And we're going to see him persevering. But if we just take the story and say, wow, this is a great story about human triumph, then we're going to completely miss the point. This is a story about God's stubborn refusal to let evil have the last word. We're going to see in Joseph's brothers and in Potiphar's wife that they did all kinds of things to him for evil, but God subverted their actions and he brought good out of it. This is a story about how God is always working all the time, not just in biblical character lives, but in your life. Making sure that evil doesn't have the last word. Making sure that no matter what you walk through, he can subvert it and he can bring good out of it for you and for the rest of the world. So just before I jump into the text this morning, I want to pass along to you a bit of a dialogue that I came across in one of the books I was reading. And I think the reason for it will be evident. It relates to this Joseph story. Here's the dialogue. Do you know why Satan is so angry all the time? Because whenever he works a particularly clever bit of mischief, God uses it to serve his own righteous purposes. So God uses wicked people as his tools? Not exactly. God gives us the freedom to do great evil if we choose. Then he uses his own freedom to create goodness out of that evil, for that is what he chooses. So in the long run, God will always win? Yes. In the short run, though, it can be uncomfortable, as you all know too well. So if your Bibles are open, just want to invite you to follow along with me as I read, starting at verse 37. Jacob lived in the land, that is the promised land, where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And he brought their father a bad report about them, his brothers. Now Israel, that is Jacob, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age. And he made for Joseph a richly ornamented robe. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brother said to him, "Do you intend to rule over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you've had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel, Jacob, said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them." "Very well," Joseph replied. So Jacob said to him, "Go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me." Then he sent him off from the valley of Hebron. From Hebron to Shechem is a journey of about 80 km. When Joseph arrived in Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, "What are you looking for?" Joseph replied, "I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they're grazing their flocks?" "They've moved on from here," the man answered. "I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan,'" which is another 20 km further. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance before he reached them, and they plotted to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams." When Reuben, the oldest, heard this, he tried to rescue Joseph from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he said. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him into a cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said this to rescue Joseph from them and to take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. Now the cistern was empty. There was no water in it. And as they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. So when the Midianites' merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in blood. They took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe." Jacob recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "in mourning I will go down to the grave to my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Now, if you will, just flip ahead to chapter 39, verse 1, and follow along with me there. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken them there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time Potiphar put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessings of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So he left in Joseph's care everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Now, the verses that follow tell a story of sexual brokenness that Pastor Dave is going to address next week. And not only that, but Genesis 38 that we passed over this morning. But let me just briefly tell you what happens in this narrative. Potiphar's wife saw that Joseph was a strapping, good-looking young man, and she attempts to seduce him. "Come, sleep with me," she says, and Joseph refuses. He will not dishonor God. He will not dishonor his master. He won't even dishonor his own body by sexual unfaithfulness. He says no. And so out of her anger and spite and humiliation, she accuses him of sexual misconduct, and Potiphar has no choice but to send him off to prison. So, if you still got your Bible open, let me invite you to let your eyes fall down to verse 20. Joseph's master, that is Potiphar, took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him, and he showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. It's an incredible story. What makes it even more incredible is that it actually happened in history. And as you make your way through this story from beginning to end, you see all kinds of stark characterizations. We're told that Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. So much so that he wanted Joseph and everyone else to know that this guy was set apart. So he made him a really fancy ornamented robe so that Joseph could walk around in his brothers and say, "Yep, Dad loves me more than the rest of you." And it's no surprise that his brothers hate him for it. Multiple times in the story, this is what we read. Now, you think that Jacob would have learned his lesson. you've been with us all summer, you know that Jacob grew up in a family where a mom and dad played favorites, and they played one son against the other, and it was absolute disaster. And here he is doing it again. In verse 4, we're told that when the brothers saw that their father loved Joseph more than them, they hated Joseph and couldn't speak a kind word to him. You know, it's interesting. You would think that in the face of such favoritism, kids would hate the parents, not the one who was loved. But that's not the way it works. Because every child was created to long for their parents' affection. And so when they see they're not getting it, instead of hating the only one they can get it from, they turn on the beloved, on Joseph. And they hatch a plan that sends him, as far as they are concerned, to his death. Any of you parents or grandparents out there, do not play favorites. It destroys every time, every time. Early on in the story, we're introduced to Joseph. He's 17 years old when we see him first. And in the first couple of verses, we're given the impression that this Joseph is morally upright. When he sees that his brothers are acting out and probably not doing what dad would want, he not only is indignant and chooses not to participate, he decides to go back to tell dad that they've all been a rather bad lot of boys that probably should be punished. Joseph is morally upright, but he also sees himself as the moral police, and that doesn't do him any favors with his big brothers. And then we have his two dreams. Both dreams, though different, are the exact same dream. Now, it's one thing to have a God dream where God reveals something to you. It's something completely different to tell it to everyone around you, particularly this kind of dream. Hey, guys, I had a dream last night. I want to tell you all about it. Really? What was it about? Well, all 12 of us were together out in the field, and we were all like these little bundles of grain, and all of a sudden, my bundle of grain stood up, and all the rest of yours bowed down to me. Isn't that awesome? There's two kinds of smarts in this world. There are book smarts, and there are street smarts, and clearly Joseph didn't have street smarts. But then he has another dream. And you'd think he would have learned his lesson the first time. But he tells it again, and this time in his dream, there's 11 stars. He has 11 brothers and a sun and moon representing his mom and dad. And this time, all of the cosmos is bowing down in front of him, and he passes it on. And he's despised. Bruce Waltke writes, "In the ancient Near East, dreams were a common means of divine communication and prediction. I suppose the question for us is, are dreams still a way that God communicates? You can't read the scriptures and get away from the fact that God speaks through dreams somewhat frequently. It's interesting that in all kinds of cultures to this day, people still pay attention to their dreams because they know that God speaks through them. To this day, for many Muslims who are now Christians, their very first encounter with Jesus happened in a dream. It didn't happen by reading the scriptures, like probably most of us. In our Western, scientific, rationalistic worldview, we've bought the lie that dreams are just a result of the bad pizza we ate the night before. Now, no doubt some dreams are resulting from what we ate the night before or the movie we watched before we went to bed. But God still does speak. And until we pay attention, we're going to miss out on something that God might want to reveal to us. Now, one might think on the basis of Joseph's dreams, his whole family and the cosmos bowing down to him, one might think that in light of these God dreams, he was destined to take off like a rocket, just onward and upward, but not so. Far from being exalted, Joseph was thrust onto a path through the decision of all kinds of others that brought him into intense places of humiliation. In fact, chapters 37 and 39 chronicle the highs and the lows of Joseph's path. Right from the beginning, he's exalted by his father, and then he is humbled by his brothers and thrown into a well. And then in slavery in Potiphar's house, an important man, he's exalted to the place where he's basically in charge of everything except for the food in front of Potiphar. But before long, he's humbled and thrown into a prison cell by a false accusation. And then there in this terrible prison, he's exalted once again by the prison warden. He sees that this is the person who can be trusted, and everything is put under his care. I want you to pay attention to all the phrases that describe the Lord's presence and favor in Joseph's life in Genesis 39. Verse 2, it says the Lord was with Joseph, that is, in slavery. Verse 3, the Lord gave him success in Potiphar's house. Verse 5, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. Verse 20 and 21, while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him. Verse 23, the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. But here's the irony. It's in slavery and in this cell prison pit that we read, the Lord was with him. The Lord was exalting him. The Lord was giving him favor. Friends, I wonder how often we make the mistake of believing that God is sovereign on a part-time basis. I mean, honestly. A pastor friend of mine once remarked that faith isn't faith until it has been tested. Most of us have little difficulty believing that God is in control when everything is going well. We sang a song earlier about blessed be your name when the sun's shining down on me, when all as it should be, blessed be your name. Well, that's easy. That doesn't take faith. But when we're walking through the valley of the shadow of death, does our belief in the sovereignty of God change? Is it shaken? There's a question that we need to wrestle with that's inherent in this biblical story this morning, and it has massive implications for the way that we live. Where was God present in Joseph's story? Was it when he was at home with his dad and everything was going great? Was God more present in Joseph's story at home with his dad than in the well or in the prison cell? See, what we need to wrap our heads and hearts around is the fact that God was just as sovereign and present and gracious in the well and the cell as he was when he was home with his dad. And friends, God is just as present in our lives and just as sovereign in our difficulties and in our pains and our suffering as he is when everything is going wonderfully. And I know that if you're anything like me, this is a really hard word to embrace, because what it means is that though Jesus might love me immensely and he might surround me on every side, he may not spare me difficulty, pain, or the evil forced upon me through other people's decisions. Last January, we held a spiritual emphasis week, and we brought in a pastor teacher from Toronto to teach us. Sundar was his name. And while he was here, he spoke some words that deal directly with this very idea in understanding the sovereignty of God and how the sovereignty of God and the pain of our lives comes together. He said that the only reason any of us pray at all is because God is sovereign. If he isn't, what's the point in praying? He can't help. God's the one who rules over all of life and history. He's the one who fully knows the plans and purposes he has for us and for all of history. And so at the macro level of history, God ensures that his plans to reconcile a broken world, make it beautiful, and put everything to rights, that marches on. It doesn't matter what any of us do. God's plan goes ahead unhindered. At the macro level, what we see is the majesty of God. But at the micro level of our own lives, when we find ourselves in a well or hidden in a prison cell or in some kind of slavery, his majesty seems to be covered with a fog of mystery. And it's hard for us to see how God's sovereignty, his presence, his love, his grace is operating at the level of here, now, in pain. We don't know what he's up to. I once heard someone say, never doubt in the darkness what God has revealed in the light. In other words, never let go of what you know to be true of Jesus, that he's loving, he died for you, that he's present, that he's strong, that he's a defender and a protector. Never let go of these things when all of a sudden you find yourself surrounded by painful mystery. God has not changed, and he has not left the building. Joseph's dreams take him on anything but this onward and upward path. His dreams land him in a well, then in slavery, and then in a cell. I told you before that Joseph, when we first meet him, is 17 years old. By the time he finally walks out of his prison cell, he's 30 years old. 13 years of painful mystery have been going on. But when he walked out of that prison cell, he walked right into the presence of Pharaoh, and within minutes, he became the second most powerful person on the face of the entire earth. Mystery and majesty, all rolled up into one. Joseph was just like us. He didn't have the benefit of knowing the end of his story right in the middle of living it. Wouldn't it be great if Joseph and us could just take our lives like a book, and if we're in chapter 2 and it's kind of an ugly chapter, just flip ahead right to the end and find out, oh great, everything works out in the end. I'll go back to chapter 3 and now I'll live with perseverance and strength and wisdom and faith. Wouldn't that be great? But it doesn't work like that. And so God calls us to this wonderful, beautiful, painful thing called faith. There is majesty at the macro level. There's mystery at the micro level. And at times in my own life, I feel like I can see how the two are working in tandem. I see it in my life. Sometimes I see it in some of your lives as we talk. Sometimes I feel like I can see it in the life of our church. And at other times, all I see and feel is hurt. And to be honest, I'm done. I don't want to contemplate how majesty and mystery work its way out. I just want the mystery to go away. I know some of you do too. But friends, it's in these places where our faith, which God says is of greater weight than gold, is being refined, it's being tested and proved. It's in these places that we hold on to what we know to be true about Jesus and trust him to be with us. No matter whether we're trapped at the bottom of a well or in a prison cell or seated on Pharaoh's throne. As I studied this week, there was one author in particular who, his name's Walter Brueggemann, and he made a connection for me that I'd never really thought of before between this Joseph story and a promise that the Apostle Paul made thousands of years later. It's found in Romans 8, 28 to 29. It reads, "And we know that God causes everything to work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose for them. For God knew his people in advance, and he chose them to become like his son so that his son would be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters." Joseph's brothers and Potiphar's wife intended evil for Joseph. That was their choice, and they were free to choose it. But God is also free to choose. And fortunately, his choices tend to subvert the choices of others. And so he chose to bring good out of this entire situation. He brought good and blessing for Joseph, ultimately, for his family, for the entire known world. And we're going to get to that later on in the story. I want you to listen once again to these words in Romans 8. God causes everything to work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose for them. Now, the problem is that most of you who know this verse, you stop dead after verse 28. And if you do, then all you've got is a half truth or a half promise. God's promise is not that everything is going to turn out well, that everything in your life will be happily ever after. It isn't even that you're going to be spared from pain because God loves you and you love him. God causes everything to work for the good of those who love God and are called to according to his purpose for them, namely, verse 29, that we will become like his son Jesus, who suffered many things. The promise is that no matter what we experience, no matter what we endure, no matter what other people force on us, that God will be at work in each difficulty and experience. And none of it will be useless. None of it will be wasted, at least not from God's end of things. That's his promise. Because God is involved, friends, even the evil that's thrust on us by other people, it doesn't have the last word. God always has the last word because he is sovereign. This morning, you already know what I'm about to say. And so I'm just reminding your hearts this morning. You have not been forgotten by God. He has not abandoned you. His presence and his favor have not been removed. Your life hasn't been discarded in this big ash heap. You haven't been thrown away or pushed to the sidelines as redundant. How could God forget you? How could he? He doesn't forget anyone, and you're too precious to be forgotten. Friends, never forget that in the darkness of your experience, Jesus is with us. He's sovereign, and he will be faithful to the end of your life and then beyond. Because this isn't the only life there is. This is just the beginning. And he'll be with us all the way through. And in a moment, I'm going to invite Steve to play a song for us. It's a song that I came across this last week or two by Matt Rebin. It's called Never Once. And it's a song that just talks about the enduring, faithful presence of the Lord. And so as it's played over the PA system, if it helps to close your eyes, go for it. If not, that's fine. I've got the words on the screen. But I want you just to receive it. Sort of like a fire hose from God. This is what is true about him. And then after we've had a chance to listen to the song, I'm going to come back up and I'm going to pray for all of us. So let me encourage you just to assume a posture of receiving from the Lord.